Well, good evening. Thank you very much for coming tonight. This is the second of two parts. If you missed the first part, do not fret. It is apparently online now and available for all to hear, should you wish. They are kind of standalone, to be fair. Last week we looked at narrative, and tonight we'll look at law, and you'll understand that they go quite nicely together, constituting quite a significant amount of the Bible. So, as I said, this is the second part. What I intend to do is to explore how we look at Old Testament law, how we listen to it, as it were, how we hear God speaking in the law, which is the least read and least used part of our Bibles, which is, for me, seeing as it's my pet area, quite surprising. I can understand that a lot of the time there's a lot of barriers between where we are right now and hearing what the text is actually saying. So, that's the purpose of tonight. You'll take away, hopefully, a handout with you, and on it you'll see some KPs, or key points, just to take away with you. It should be on the back of your handout. And these are just things to remember when reading the legal material to help you get a head start, to help you think, right, I know what I'm doing. These are the things which will help me get the most out of it. So that's the plan for this evening. Now, I believe that when we read the law, that we are listening to God, and we are listening to the very voice of God that is revealing himself. And so I think it's utterly appropriate before we go anywhere near this or our biblical texts that we pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, indeed we ask you to bless us. I pray, Heavenly Father, that you'd enable us to simply be able to read your word better and deeper, and to be able to meet with you and to find you, Lord, in the text. You said that if we seek you, you will be found. And we thank you for that. And I pray that this evening will be a time of equipping, that we will be able indeed to learn and to apply it in our lives, I pray. In Jesus' wonderful name. Amen. Okay. Let me start off by getting you all warmed up. Let me ask you a question. I want you to respond to this. I'll give you a moment to think about it, perhaps even discuss it with the person beside you or people around you, and then we'll kind of filter back. So, what do we think of when we think of the term law? Now, I mean this in a biblical sense. Law. I realize there are many applications out with that. But when I'm thinking of the Bible, when I'm thinking of law, what do we think of? And I want you to think of, kind of emotionally, what does that mean? What texts do we mean? What do you think it means, as it were? So, over to you, just to warm me up then. What do we think of when we think of the term law? Over to you. That's a bit of a worrying sign, but don't worry, we'll work on that as we go through this evening. So, what do we think of when we think of the term law? Moses. Good. Yeah, good start. Okay, so Moses. Yes? Yeah, everyone okay with Moses? That's a good one. Justice. Yeah. Good. So the kind of purpose maybe of the law, yeah? So we've got an author, we've got a purpose. What else? Yes, difficult to read. You know, there's a reason that Leviticus is the least read book in the Bible. Apparently. You know, there's a reason it is difficult to read. Yes, there was something else. First five books, yes, very often. Books of Moses, Law of Moses, Law and the Prophets. When you see it in this kind of context, it usually means the first five books. Yes.
Isn't
that a bit scary as well? A bit scary. It can be scary for two reasons. One, just approaching it. You've got the Ten Commandments, you've got, yeah. Brilliant. Now, how many other people were actually secretly thinking that? They didn't have the guts to say so. If it's a law, you're right. You know, there's like, do this, do this, do this, cover that up, don't do that, do this, don't do that. You know, there's a whole range of things going on, and you've got to obey. Because if it's a law, you've got to obey. And you've got to obey the lawgiver. Maybe a judge kind of figure. a kind of hanging judge kind of figure. And when we use the word law, to be fair, that is very often what we have in the background. You know, even at a subconscious level, that's very often what comes up, this kind of, I better keep it, you know. Or worse, which bits will I keep? You know, and then we get into ourselves into a real tangle after that. Okay, anything else? Good. Sacrifices, absolutely. In fact, that's going to be one of our key areas that we're going to look at tonight. Sacrifices in the Old Testament, sometimes requiring blood, often requiring something getting burned. There was quite a few different sacrifices in the Old Testament, starting from the garden onwards. Very important element, sacrifice. Particularly if we want to discuss what Jesus achieved on the cross. Lots of Christians, even today, will argue what Jesus achieved on the cross. You know, especially lots of scholars will argue it's this, it's that, or the next thing. But we largely have a blueprint in the book of Leviticus. Now, there are other elements like victory over Satan, which we have promised in the garden and things. But largely speaking, if we understand the sacrificial system and all the different ways that sin permeates and affects the human experience, we begin to understand what it is exactly we've been freed from. What is exactly that's been paid for? So, yeah, that's a pretty big one. Thank you. Okay, anything else? This is actually a very good point. Again, that's two already. there's an element about it being... that's two already. Very good ones. Because the thing about a law is you have to do it. Right? You don't just sit around talking about it. You have to do it. And there is a wonderful, practical, tangible element to it, which requires us to get up and do something. Which I think sometimes can be missing from some of our lives. That impetus to always be doing something in the right way is part of the consequence of the legal material. How we do it and what we do exactly, I think we need to think about and read it and really delve into the depths of the text. But the beautiful thing about this kind of text, unlike last week where we had the narrative, which was catching our imagination and teaching us through story, here we've got a real compulsion to do something ourselves. Beautiful text as a result. It's also a very challenging text as a result. It's all very well teaching us some ideas, but when we're actually told, okay, now you have to go live them, that's quite a challenge to us all. Okay, that's a pretty good start for the evening. When we have it applied in the Bible, very often we can have this kind of idea, you know, the judge, the angry fella, because one of the problems with the law is that we're going to run foul of it. We're not going to be able to entirely keep all of it. Not because we couldn't, but probably because we just don't want to in our hearts of hearts 100% of the time. There's those times where, quite frankly, we don't want to keep the law. And we break it. And therefore, we have this idea, and not one that I'm entirely happy with, but we have this idea of God acting like a judge in that way. I suppose the one who draws a line of judgment over everything we've done and frees us from it. It's a very different concept. So, with regard to the Bible, the law with capital letters, thinking of it with some emphasis, the law, you know, you're going to feel that one, you know. The law and the prophets, we could have Mosaic law, the idea of a legal code, rules, which is kind of brought up, but also covenant, that the covenant people got the law. This is actually very important. Some of us may be under the impression that the law was the means by which people were able to please God and then gain their salvation. That's palpably not true. The law was given to people who are already the people of God. They were already called a nation of priests. They were already called the precious jewels of God in Exodus 19. They already have status as the people of God, and as a beautiful gift from God, he gave them the law. So that's one of the key things we have to stamp out immediately, the idea of gaining salvation through keeping the law. It has to be utterly eradicated from our minds, as it were. because it just simply is not true, and it's not there anywhere in the Bible, and it's certainly not true for us today. The Hebrew word, and let's be honest, we all knew that some Hebrew words are going to pop up at some point this evening, but the Hebrew word is the word Torah. It's a beautiful word. It doesn't mean law. We translate it as law, but it doesn't mean law. It means something much, much, much bigger. The Greek word that we have for it is Pentateuch. It's a great word. It just means five books. And largely means, as we had over here, the first five books of the Bible. The Torah is bigger than that. It includes the narrative. It includes the legal material, which I do not want to undermine, looking at it as we will this evening. But the Torah also includes songs and poems, as well as stories and law. And all of it together paints a picture. And the picture, first and foremost, is not about us. The picture, first and foremost, is not about how we should live and how we should be. That's a secondary thing. The picture that is being painted is a picture of God. Who he is. What he thinks. So if God is seen to act, like we said last week, if he's seen to act on behalf of those who are unloved and those who are vulnerable, we see something about him. Someone who would do that, it reveals something about him. When we look at the law and he says, I don't want you to do this, I want you to do this. He's telling us what is important to him. It reveals his nature. That's what makes it so precious. We actually see God. Surely I'm not the only one in this room whose mind's just blowing at the idea that we get a snapshot of the one who created heaven and earth. In the law. When we make a law, you know, the kind of thing that we have to obey every single last bit of it, it becomes all about us. When we understand that it is Torah, that it is painting a picture of God, we can appreciate the way that the Jews describe the Torah. They describe it as God made flesh. As a Christian, it has a particular resonance. We have an ultimate God made flesh. In whom? Good, is the Sunday school answer? I was kind of hoping that we would be able to get there, yes. Jesus! Jesus is the ultimate God made flesh. And he takes upon himself this idea of being the law alive. So, if somebody was to embody the law, if someone was to actually live a life that was representing the law in perfection, it would be Jesus Christ. He lived the law. He lived the Torah, because he's the ultimate God made flesh. The Torah, written by him, bear in mind, originating with him, reveals himself. Now that's worth getting excited about. But that really messes up how we read the law. That really kind of does something to us. We have to really think about, right, how do I read a book which is all about revealing who God is? And then what do I do with it? It's a very different set of questions. You see, with the law, it's pretty easy. You just do it. And if there's some odd bits in there, we just ignore it, you know, and hope it goes away. If it is God made flesh, and it is telling us who God is, then all these laws are not so much do this, do this, do this. It's saying, this is how I feel as God. Do you feel the same way? Are you going to be my people? Are you going to look like a Torah life lived? Are you going to look like me? Are you going to imitate Christ? A different bar all of a sudden. Keeping the law, that's actually an easy bar. Actually living lives that reflect God like a mirror. Now that's something big. That's something exciting. Okay, essentially, as far as I'm concerned, if you have the wrong question when you're approaching the text, i.e., how does this law apply to me? Do I keep this law today? How do I keep it? We're going to get the wrong answers. If we approach it as, this reveals God, what does it reveal? What does that ask of me? As the last question, that we get it in the right order and we can have really fruitful answers. We can begin to hear what the text is saying. You see, when we think of a law without a narrative, if we think of a law without the poetry, when we think of a law without all these things, and we kind of isolate it out into a legal material that we just simply, almost unemotionally look at, we fail to really grasp the beauty of the text. So this idea of God made flesh is what's underpinning tonight. Anyone else feeling slightly daunted, blown away? Yeah, that's just the first few minutes. Just hold on to your seats. So, what is the purpose of the law? In other words, why is it important today? Well, I've already described that it is revealing the very nature of God. It had other benefits, to be fair. Now, it provides a framework of God enabling us to see sin. So in other words, he is identifying the things which are harmful to us and the things which are good for us. So when it says, do not kill, it's identifying that as that's a no-no, that's a sin, don't go down that line. That is the opposite of where I am. And so we have a framework to see. It's not therefore up to us to decide what is right and wrong. We can see it there, written down by the only one who really knows what is right and what is not. It leads us, therefore, to see why we need Christ. When we see who God is, and we recognize just how much we fall short, we recognize that we are in desperate need of salvation. Particularly, that's the main reason that we fail to keep the law, is our own broken nature, refusing to keep the law. We often have this idea that we could not live up to the standards of the law. Now, if it was just simply the legal material, do this, do this, do this, it's actually not that hard. Now, I believe that you may be somewhat skeptically looking at me at this point, but I have a video, and as everyone knows, that will surely prove the case. Now, I need to applaud at the end of something like that. Now, that was essentially the book of Leviticus in a song. I'd still encourage you to read it, don't get me wrong, but that was essentially it, all summed up. And the great line about loving your neighbour as yourself comes from that wonderful book. You see, there is still, no matter how I talk about it as being God revealed, etc., there is still, because of this onus on action, there are still things for us to do. And each of these things that people were asked to do. Now, there were reasons for it. There were reasons for having your hair a particular way. There were reasons for having your clothes a particular way. Because God really cared about these things. Why he cared, we're actually going to come to in just a few while. And so the people would have kept these things, and it is a necessary thing for us to look at these texts and think, why? Why were these things important to God? And in what way can I live a life that reflects God as is revealed in that text? And this evening, I'm afraid we'll only be able to look at three examples. I wish we could do the whole book of Leviticus and do every single one. But that would probably require more than the time we have this year. So, we have the purpose of the law. It provides a framework for us to see sin. And as I said, it leads us to Christ because we cannot keep the law. And it restrains sin by knowing what it is. We can not do it, as it were. But here's a really beautiful thing. It maintained Israel's distinctiveness. One of the key reasons given by God for the law is that it made Israel distinct. It made them different. I don't just mean odd different. I mean God different. Something which is required of all of us. It is utterly insufficient to find yourself at the end of your life and have lots of people say that you are a nice person. It's not enough. You need to be able to see that you're one of God's people. And so being God different, not just annoying different or awkward different, I'm very painfully aware of the differences between them, but God different. And that's where the law comes in. We'll be looking at. And so Israel was different from everyone all around them because their God was different. Why is it important that we are God different? Because the person who lives here, the creator of heaven and earth, is vastly different than what motivates the people around us, that guides the people around us, that ensnares the people around us. The way that we live, the way that we act, should reflect the creator. And not some of the darkest parts of the creation. And so the law comes in and says, this is how to be God different. It's beautiful. As I said, we'll do three examples of this tonight. There is, of course, a huge element of it being in the welfare of the Israelites. There are a number of things to do with health and crops and things, which actually were for their benefit. before the time of refrigeration, for example, there is a very strict code on what you can and cannot eat, how you eat it, when you eat it, etc. There is, the Sabbath day. Now, one of the reasons for the Sabbath, and I'm not saying this is the only reason for the Sabbath, but one of the ones given is for rest, genuine rest, 1 and 7. And what's really beautiful, because this really kind of feeds into the whole thing, it was rest for everyone. There's a great sense of equality in the Sabbath, because in every other society, it was only ever the rich who could afford to have a day off. Here, everybody was to have a day off, even the animals. Or to have a day off. Everyone, no matter who you were, no matter what you did. And you weren't supposed to be losing out because of it. And you didn't have to worry, if you had a business, you didn't have to worry about the business down the road, maybe putting you out of business because they're still working, because everybody had the day off. Beautiful. Universal. One of the reasons that is given is for rest. It's for the welfare of Israel. So if they kept the law, they'd be healthier. Very often they'd be wealthier. They'd be happier. If they kept to the law. So that's a rather important element as well. But as I said at the very outset, these are things which are true about the legal material, but ultimately it all hangs together on the fact that it reveals God's nature and his priorities. That's what it all hangs on, as it were. Okay, certainly if we wish to apply any of it into our lives. There are a number of economic, political, religious elements within the law that act as a fabric for the society to come around, that protects individuals. I think, as I said last week, there are more laws concerning women than there are men. There are more laws for women than there are men. Now, if it's a law, that seems a bit unfair. they've got more to have to do. They've got more to obey than men do. That's not fair. But, in actual fact, in the ancient Near East, it's a sad fact that women were a vulnerable group. If you don't believe me, read some of the world histories or look at any of the war-torn areas right now, one of the groups of people that suffer the most are women. The heart of man is decidedly wicked above all things. And we see vulnerable groups always exploited. Whereas the law, the rules, said that women had to be educated, which is a great equaliser. It said that women had the right to property. Again, an incredible inheritance from God. But there's a whole lot of extra laws because the women were to be protected from men. And what's behind all of this is part of the nature of God, looking after the vulnerable, looking after those who would be exploited. And it's a beautiful thing. It's not something to be annoyed about because of extra laws for women. It's something to say, wow, God is on the side of those who would be mistreated. Let me just give you one example, not in Leviticus, but in Numbers. If a woman was suspected of adultery, so just suspicion, there's no evidence, it's just in the head of the husband. He had to go with her to the temple. and the priest there would give her a drink. She would have to drink it, and they'd have to go home. And it was left with God. The other equivalent would be somewhere like Babylon, the Babylonian code. And they said there that if a man suspected, so no evidence, no actual tangible proof or anything like that, but just suspected his wife, or even just said, because he was fed up with her, that he suspected her of adultery, what he was supposed to do was tie her up and throw her in the river. Can you feel how different those two things are? Can you feel how it is that God is saying, we are different, we're not like that. As if all these laws appear to protect people because that's what God would want. It's beautiful. It really is quite moving to see all of these laws. And so that was just one example to try and show what I mean. Okay, I better keep going, of course. The heart of the law is the Shema. That's in Deuteronomy 6. I've got some of it here. Let's just read it. I've kept it in a rather old style to precipitate one of you, actually. Could one of you open up a Bible? If you've got a church Bible, that'll be an NIV version. If you've got something else with you, then feel free. And could one of you read out the Shema? It's verses 4 to 9 in Deuteronomy 6 that I'm looking for. Now, this is very much the core of the law. This is very much the beating heart of it. In fact, this is the very first text that a Jewish child is supposed to hear on being born. It is the first one they are supposed to learn when learning their scriptures. And it is the text that is supposed to be said daily, twice, by every Hasidic Jew, first thing in the morning and last thing at night. So it's pretty important. It's no different at the time of Christ. When he's asked what is the most important commandment, he turns around and takes a piece of this. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your soul, and might. Slightly alternative translation would be you shall love the Lord your God with everything that makes you human, everything within you. And with all of the outward part of you, with your body, to the very last breath, to the last drop of blood, and to the very last ounce of your strength and potential. Yeah, the Hebrew is a beautiful language. And it talks about how we're to teach these to our children. This is what we pass on. This is the greatest gift that we can pass on to our children. You're going to talk about it when you sit in the house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you get up. And this is a very famous Hebrew way of describing things. So it talks about the heights and the depths. It's not just talking about heights and depths, but everything in between, as it were. And so when it says, you know, when you're lying down and when you're getting up and when you know, first thing in the morning and last thing, it's talking about, yes, those moments, but everything in between. It says you should have them on the front of your head, as it were. So you should actually have them right there. Some people will literally have a piece of the Torah written out and attached to their forehead. But more likely it's talking about we should have them just on the tip of our tongue, at our fingertips, we would say. And it says we should have it on our hand. And again, some people will actually bind a piece of the Bible onto their hand. But what that means is everything that you do with your hands, your actions, should be governed by this. And everything to do with your eyes. Everything that you see, when you're looking at it, it should be judged. It should be analysed by the criteria given here. That makes sense. Right, here's my question. What is, do you think, the key word in all of this? Because if we're thinking law, we should see the word obey in there somewhere. But we don't have obey. We don't even have do. What do we have instead of obey? Love. Yes, thank you. Love. We've got love. It's a very strange law, isn't it? And the core of it, the foundation of it, the heart of it, is love. It's talking about a relationship. The law is within this relationship. It is a means of us loving. It's a way of us showing that we love God by wanting to be like him. Love. Not do, not obey. Love. It's a very different foundation than the one we'd often think of when it comes to law. And when we were talking earlier about the law being scary, that's very often because the word love is not being used. The idea of loving God and Him loving us has been lost. So, the Torah and the legal material helps us with the relationship with God. An analogy would be, and I say this nervously knowing that my wife will probably hear the recording of this later on, but when I first got in tow with Mary, my wife, I would have been so grateful for some sort of manual to come with her. You know, like you get for a dishwasher or a microwave or something. You know the kind of thing I mean, with an index at the front and you just look at, you know, and it answers all the questions. I'm not saying I would have killed for one, but pretty close. I've savagely beaten someone for one anyway. I mean, it would be a remarkable thing to have, you know. She comes in, she says, okay, Ian, will I wear the blue top or the red one? I go, okay, haha, page 71 in the manual, just give me a moment. Leave now, say nothing. Okay! Ah, oh, it would have been wonderful to have that kind of shortcut. And instead, I had to learn through giving all the wrong answers, as it were. And yet, here, with all of these wonderful things about tattoos and hair and clothes and fields and everything else, we actually have a guide to the heart of God. We have a guide to who He is. We don't have to go trial and error. We don't have to go, okay, that was wrong, God's not happy. No, we can know what a precious thing that is to actually have at our fingertips. A guide to the heart of God. We don't have to guess. It's right there. So, how do we actually access it? So having built this all up, you know, and talked about it in this way, how do we actually access it? How do we hear what it is that the text is saying? Well, there's a phrase that kind of makes me slightly uncomfortable, but it's probably fair. To rightly interpret the text, in order to then apply it for us today, we have to discover the timeless truth beneath the cultural husk. I told you I'm slightly uncomfortable with it, but it is true. You see, the law is given to a very specific people for a specific time. How we do it today, post-Christ, might look slightly different. But I believe it has to have the same purpose, the same foundation, the same cause. Because it's still the same God who's being revealed. And so both before Christ and after Christ, the principle will remain the same. But the application may look slightly different. Or indeed, very different on occasion. Now, some of them are pretty easy because some of them, we're looking to seek the principle and then apply it, are actually quite straightforward. So, could someone read to me, please, Exodus 20, verse 13. This is supposed to be the easy one that we can see how to apply today. A lot of us tonight to try and delve the depths of that text. Yes? Please tell me I'm not the only one thinking this is a relatively straightforward text. Don't get me wrong, we can go into, you know, what Hebrew word is being used, what exactly is meant by murder, etc. But, let's be entirely honest, we kind of know what that's saying. Yeah, good. So, you know what, there are plenty of texts that actually, you know, we're looking for the principle. Well, the principle actually pretty easy to spot, and the application of it is actually identical today as it would have been back then. And there are plenty of other texts which act in a similar manner. However, there are some texts that I think can be quite tricky. That you can't just read in isolation. That you need to read in their context, in their wider kind of chapters. That you need to kind of maybe think before we apply. So, could somebody read for me Leviticus 19, verse 19? Now, there are therefore some texts which may require a little bit of thinking. It might be because we don't have a field. We'd be tempted maybe to just dismiss the text. And we're going to come back to that later on. We might be thinking, does God really care about how I dress? And some of you are looking at me thinking, I hope not for your sake, but, you know, does God really care about what we wear? And my answer, I have to say, is yes, He does. Yes. And it's really difficult for us. We live in a country where most of the clothing that we can purchase is done by the exploitation of other people. So if you can buy a pair of trainers that are £20 cheaper, but a child went blind having to make them, do you think God cares? If we can get a pair of trousers cheaper, but those people are in slave conditions and perhaps the building is going to collapse on top of them, do you think God cares? Yes. And he doesn't care more about us because we're in a more affluent country. God still cares about these things. And there's an awful lot that we can do about it. The choices of companies that I wish to give money to is surprisingly restricted. But it is actually very difficult for us because the vast majority of the options are which one's the least worst. You know, we can have a whole night on ethics and actually opening up these sorts of questions, and there are many websites to help us find out things behind what's going on. But the real question is, does God care and do we? Not do we get it right every time so much, that'd be, again, the legalistic approach, but do we actually care? Do we pretend that God doesn't? So when we read a text like that, when we talk about clothing, do we instantly dismiss it, thinking, well, God wouldn't care about that? I don't think so. But do you see how we have to think a little in terms of applying it today? Let me give another brilliant example. Leviticus 19, we'll stick with that chapter, verses 27 to 28. Now, let's be entirely honest, I am a perfect example of what not to do when it comes to this text. The text there and later on in chapter 21, verse 5, says, do not shave off the corners of your beard. And indeed, we'll continue not to shave off the top of your head either. Now, some of you are thinking, fair enough, it's not a good look. That's not a good look to be sporting therein, you know? I would like to suggest that this text matters and it goes beyond simply what we do with our facial hair. Now, you're free to disagree with me, but we're going to take a moment now for you guys to look at that text in Leviticus 19. And indeed, you can also look at the one in Leviticus 21, verse 5. And look at them, and with the person beside you, talk about what you think it means. Talk about what you think this means for you today. How are you going to apply it? And for the ladies in the room, I am including you. How are you going to apply this text today? Okay, over to you. Beards. You shall not cut, you shall not round the corners of your heads, nor shall you cut off the corners of your beards. Making me, obviously, somewhat of a transgressor, if we think of it as a law. We may be tempted to dismiss something like this. You know, how could God really care about beards and hairstyles? Particularly if you're one of the ladies in the room, you may be particularly thinking, how can a law about beards possibly apply to me? And I'll be hearing your answers in just a moment. But it's a very good question. And this, I think, is a very, very good example. It's one of my favourite examples of trying to show that sometimes there is a gap between what we have and how we apply it today. And we need to think. It's not impossible. The answers are there. It might require that we actually think about things. So, having said that, what's the answer? What's this text mean for us today? So when we leave here today, how will this affect who we are?
Maybe they fill up so they come out in the air shower or whatever. and some folk aren't, and you see the difference. And it's a case of how you present yourself. You know, some people hide stuff behind the beard, or you can't hide. That's what I think. Honestly, I'm just a bit weary.
Beware of the bearded man. I'll ask in just a moment. Okay, so is it that God is warning us about bearded men, or is it the idea of being transparent, which is quite a good bit? Is it essentially that God has begonophobia, which is a fear of beards?
Knowing that you are asking the question,
yes.
Perhaps it may have something to do with the Hebrew root of the word.
It could do. It could.
Maybe, and I'm cheating here, yep. It isn't that I have been to pay so much deep attention to your Hebrew lessons. I've cheated here slightly, but maybe it has more to do with the Hebrew root of the word having something to do with marring, spoiling, and violence.
Good. It does, yes. There's a shortcut answer, which is to learn Hebrew. I'll be honest, that's a shortcut that will give you the answer in like three, I was going to say easy steps, that would just be a complete misrepresentation. Three horrifically more difficult than you could possibly imagine, but worth it steps. However, I don't believe that you have to learn Hebrew to grasp what's going on here. There is another way of gathering information about this verse.
Anything to do with the recurring phrase that we get through all these, you know, apparently random things. At the end of them, very, very frequently in this section, we've got, I am the Lord, I am the Lord your God. And we're wondering if, kind of on the threshold of going into the promised land, God is preparing them to be distinctive from everybody else around them in the way that in Corinth, the way you did your hair made you distinctive from the way that David did your hair. So it was a kind of, you're not like them.
Yeah.
And you still get the things in both countries.
I'll come back to them if you want. But this, very much, starting in verse 2, but all the way through, we have this refrain, for, in other words, because, the reason I'm giving you all these things is because I am the Lord. Now, that's a rather interesting piece of information. Again, at verse 2 and at the end of chapter 20, we also have this notion of holiness being brought in, that we are somehow set apart, that we are different because of all of this. So if the people of God, as Dominic rightly said, they're about to enter the land, and this land is filled with peoples, lots of different kinds of peoples, but this people who are about to enter are different. They are God different. They are the people of God. And so God is saying, because I am the Lord, you will do these things. Because you are a holy people, a people who are set apart for me, you're going to do these things. Yeah. Because this is the text, chapter 19, chapter 20 and 21, they all go together in one piece. And if you read the beginning of the chapter, and we read to the end of chapter 20 in particular, we begin to get a better picture. There's lots of references, for example, to witchcraft and idolatry and things like that. And what it would appear to be is that this, just from the text alone, without adding information, that this is in some way a contrast to everyone else. This is in some way a contrast to the idolaters and those involved in witchcraft. Somehow, doing this was the opposite of what they did. So we can infer, therefore, that the people who did cut off the corners of their beard, the people who did shave off the tops of their head, in some way are idolatrous. They're synonymous with idolatry. Now, adding in some of the extra material that we know about, the Moloch worshippers in particular had this look. And the Moloch worshippers are a particularly odious group of people who would burn their own children to death in the service of Moloch. And they would walk down the street and you'd be able to spot them because they had this look that was different. And they went, oh yeah, yeah, I know who they are. And God is saying, do not even look like them. Because I am poles apart from Moloch. I am the Lord. I'm not Moloch. I don't want you looking like them. I don't want my people being confused for one of them. Because you're supposed to be so different. So like me. You're going to stand out. You're going to be so like me that people will be able to spot you going down the road and think, there goes one of the people of God. Be different because I am different. Now, does that apply to us? Does such an idea, such a notion, such a principle apply to us today? Some of you are looking a little bit sceptical. Okay, let me continue this way. Could somebody read for me Romans 12, verse 2? Romans 12, verse 2, please. And this idea of not being conformed to the world, not being like them, but being transformed, is very much relevant for us today. A modern analogy, I suppose, would be, if Christianity was made illegal, would there be enough evidence to convict you? A famous Christian statement, but one worth thinking about, because it kind of ties into this whole idea of how different are we, how much do we stand out as the people of God? Would we be rounded up for being the people of God? Would there be no way of denying it because our lives have been so different as to say, yes, I'm one of the people of God? I believe that applies today. And I hope that you can begin to see the difference that we're coming up with between the law, following the rules, and seeing the Torah, seeing the beating heart of God and thinking, that's what I want. That's what I want to be like. Does anyone know who this gentleman is? Yes, famous fashionista Gokwa. Now, if you don't know who he is, you are a blessed and fortunate human being indeed. However, if we follow it like a law, then God is essentially being equated with someone like him. God is essentially saying, oh, that is so the wrong look. That was last season. We need to go for a much fuller option when we go into the land. That's how ridiculous we make it when we turn it into a law that we've got to keep like that. That is how ridiculous it becomes. No wonder people will mock it if they think that that's what it's all about. And instead, we need to see that, yes, the people at the time would have kept this, but we've got to see that the purpose of it, the reason that God gave it, which we can understand just by reading around, reading the other verses, reading the chapters, that there is something for us today to do. And let us be different. Let us be different from those around us because we are living lives marked by God, because we imitate him. There's only one person that ever lived the law, and he was murdered. It's an easy thing that we're asked to do. Jesus Christ is the only person who managed to do it. But what a calling it is to be God different. Okay, so that's example number one. Next one. Field laws. Ah, yes. We've got to have a few field laws thrown in here. So, sticking with Leviticus 19, just there, because we've already established what, generally speaking, these chapters are about. So here we go, Leviticus 19, verse 9 to 10. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not completely harvest to the corner of your field, neither shall you gather the gleaning of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, neither shall you gather the fallen fruits of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Now, I'm going to give you a few moments to look at that. Thinking about how we talked about the beards and things, I want you to think about these verses and think, what is it about these verses so that when I leave here tonight, I am more God different? And if your answer is, I don't have a field, we're still thinking about a law. What's the purpose of this? How does it apply to us? Over to you. What does this mean for us today. I'm going to look to those, first of all, who don't have any fields. So my apologies to those who do. But, you know, those who don't have any fields, first of all, because what do we do with that? If your answer is I don't know, that is an acceptable answer, bear in mind. But what do we think?
He's calling us not to be completely ruthless and try to extract all the value we possibly can just for ourselves.
Yes, yes. Putting ourselves at the centre and extracting everything for ourselves. We've got to bear in mind that the harvest, they've had to work really hard for the harvest. So something they have worked really hard for. And yet even then, they're not to exact the full amount for themselves. Yeah. Anything else?
Share
Yeah, there's a strong element of sharing. The Old Testament view very much was that every single thing that you have comes from the hand of God, so don't hold on to it too tightly. You know? Very much so.
They didn't have to reap the poor field, then give some of it to the poor. The poor had to, the poor were, it was left to the poor to do some work.
Correct.
Well,
yes.
So the poor kept their, had some self-esteem and kept their value, and weren't like sitting beside the road waiting to be handed to, they had a purpose in life as well.
Absolutely. It's a very good system, actually, that they are provided for, and yet there's an onus on them to come and actually do the work. To take it. It's very good, actually, yeah, in terms of self-esteem, in terms of it being a viable system. It is remarkably good, yes. It shows a wonderful insight into the very nature of humanity from both the giver and the receiver. Yeah.
One of the interesting things from a farmer's perspective,
yes.
Is that, of course, they only got the harvest once a year.
Yeah.
And that was to feed and look after them and their family for the rest of the year. What it doesn't say is get sufficient to feed your family for the year and then give the rest to the poor. It actually says that no matter how good or how bad your harvest is,
yes.
And whether you think you've had enough for the year or not, you still have to think about and leave that.
Yes. I mean, very often this would actually require genuine sacrifice. This is not, you know, in all of your abundance, make sure there's a little left over for someone else, which may indeed happen on the good years, but it may also on the bad years be quite a sacrifice for them. So, you know, it's not as if, you know, oh, well, you know, when I've made my 10th million, then I will give away, you know, a couple of £100. You know, it is very much, you know, no, as you are now, think. We've got to bear in mind that in these communities it's very close-knit community. You knew exactly who was going to be going without. You knew exactly what was going on. When we think about it in our own community, if you come to Gill, for example, our church community, you know, there's sometimes, you know, we have these different groups that we can maybe join ourselves to. I'm a man with children, so I should be assigned the family group. I should only mix with them, and we should only ever talk to those people on a Sunday morning, as it were. And of course, that whole attitude is wrong. If you know me, I don't neatly fit into any box anyway. I kind of bounce around, as it were, being me. But it is very easy for us to just to kind of drift. And then we're not aware of the poor and the marginalised in our own community. Those who are oppressed, because they're not in our group. It can make our group a bit messy, wouldn't they? You know? I've heard many people, for example, pray for God to fill a church with people. But what we really mean when we say that is, God, fill a church with people like me. You know, we don't want to have to make room for wheelchairs or you know, other, you know, considerations like that. It'd be far too messy. Texts like this speak to us on a number of levels. And first of all, it's saying, who are the poor and the marginalised and the oppressed in our community? First step, think about our community as a church. This is the believing people that we're talking about here. Before we even start thinking beyond that. And very, very often, you know, we like to just drift along week by week and mix with our own people. I'm saying we, I'm not casting any aspersions or pointing any fingers. I'm probably just as bad. You know, when I'm in church, I normally seek out the same two dozen people to see how they are, etc. Of course we do, you know. Meet up with the same people outside of church because we've got something in common. Probably want to talk about the Old Testament, if I'm entirely honest. Actually, yeah, I mean, that's another very good point, because very often, I'll be honest, we can very often come to church for us, as if coming to church was all about me, and I have to receive, and I have to get, and I have to get the full harvest to the very extent, you know, and if whoever is preaching that morning hasn't quite given a message that I liked, then therefore I'm going to be in a huff. I've done that in the past, I don't know about you. Not for a while, and I'm not going to look at Dominic at this point because that'd be a bit awkward, but actually, I mean, when I was younger, before I was here, you know, that was my attitude. You know, I'd go to church thinking, well, that message wasn't very good, it wasn't very much speaking to me this morning, not thinking that it might have spoken to everybody else in the building. You know, I wanted the full harvest for myself. And we do that very often. We can make church about ourselves, and you are right, church is not about us, it's about God. And God said, this is how I feel. Do you feel the same way?
We should feel a father's
hope. Should do. Yep.
People lying in the street in the gutter and seeing the good quality, what violence are dying in the street.
And this is the big difference between Torah and law. See, this is a law. What you do is you would go to your field and you would do it. And then you'd be able to look God in the eye and say, well, I am a good person. I have met all the requirements. You can check the list. I have earned the gratitude of God. Particularly odious and highly erroneous attitude to take. Or worse, what we'd do is we'd employ a lawyer. Because normally if we get a law, we just work round it. We get the lawyer and the lawyer goes, oh no, that's not a field. That's a large garden with wheat. Therefore, he is not under the jurisdiction of this law. That's what we would normally do as human beings. But this as a Torah, not as a law, but as a Torah, as this is God speaking and revealing something about himself, this says, this is how I feel. Do you feel the same way? Everything you can say, think, or do comes under that. Everything. Every breath we take comes under the idea of being like God. Taking on the family likeness of the Father. And that's where this really comes in. Do we feel the same way? So it's not a legal list. And the one who never changes is not tomorrow going to say, well, actually, these poor, a bit burdensome, really. I think I'll just cut my ties with them. The God who is clearly on the side of the poor in a vast array of laws and narratives isn't going to change. But when we see Jesus Christ living on earth, what group does he naturally gravitate toward? Well, the very people that he's always saying are important to him. People with no value, as far as society is concerned. And yet when God weighed up the value of these people, he decided it was worth his own death. And that was the value that he felt belonged to these people, these marginalized people. And in our churches, we should reflect this. We should reflect the fact that the people that we see, God died for, because that was the value he placed on them. What are we going to do? It doesn't take a lot to say good morning. But it is a good start.
Oh, running out of time as always. So, the last one, the third example that I wish to look at is to do with the sacrificial system. I think I intimated at the beginning that this would be where we ended up. Leviticus again, might as well. We've already got that open in our Bibles. Leviticus 4:29 says this, and he shall lay his hand upon the head of the sin offering and slay the sin offering in the place of the burnt offering. Now,
What does that mean for us today? And if you think that we should ask the elders to do some sacrifices at the front of the church, then we'll have a small support group later on that you can take part in. So what does this mean? Because very often as Christians we'll say, but Christ didn't deal with all of that. And turn our backs on it. Forget it. I would like to posit that this says something to us today and should have an effect on us today. What does it say? Over to you. I'll talk about that for much longer, but I had better stop you there in your tracks. So, looking at that text, what are we to take from that with us tonight?
Yeah.
Very much so. I'm going to underline that point actually very much in just a moment. Despite the fact that was a remarkably good answer, is there anything else anyone wishes to posit?
You are acting out your responsibility.
Yes.
And by having to slay the animal yourself, you're acting out the responsibility for something that serious that requires blood to be shed to cover it.
Yes.
So you're not absolving yourself. So I didn't mean to do it. You know, actually, if you'd thought more carefully, if you'd had a stronger sense of duty of care, or if you'd been more loving and anticipating what you could do for other people, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It is breathtaking that these are for unintentional sins. There's no recourse for those who do on purpose. Psalm 51, the heartbreak of David, is the recourse for sins done on purpose, which is to plead for mercy. These are for the unintentional ones, the ones he didn't mean to do. But perhaps he could have avoided. If you'd lived the way you were supposed to live, if you'd lived a Torah life, these things wouldn't have come up. But also the seriousness of it. How many of you have killed an animal? Okay, some of you, that disturbs me. Some of you are going to say, why? Yes. It's the kind of maniacal gleam in some of your eyes. I'm going to stand on this side now. It's a serious thing. At least it should be. I grew up in a place where we would kill animals, we would eat them. Start off with rabbits and work your way up the scale. Now I want to. Absolutely. The seriousness of this, really, we sometimes don't quite grasp. The wealth of the people was largely determined by the animals they had. both the ones that they actually have and their breeding potential, so that the animals they could have because of them. And it's saying, take your very best. So not just the ones that, all right, fair enough, I'm going to lose one, I'll take this scrawny beast over here, it's only got two legs, you know. It's actually saying, no, your very, very best, and the potential breeding lines, and everything that represented. This is going to be a huge cost. You had to take it with your hand. You had to take it to the place of sacrifice. It would have been bleating away, fighting against you, because it knows what's going to happen. And you have to drag it in and tie it down to the altar. And you don't just pass it off to the priest. The priest passes you the knife. And you take the knife. You cut its throat. Smell the blood. The cries die. And the life goes out in its eyes. You should be struck by the seriousness of what is taking place. That blood is required for even those unintentional sins. It's a very serious thing. And when we read it, we're not supposed to think, oh, how barbaric, or how we should leave that in the past. We should be struck by the seriousness of what is going on. Because if we could go on a field trip just now, through time, to the foot of the cross. And stand there, hearing his cries, smell the blood, and the life going out in his eyes when he cries it is finished. Knowing that it is our sin, even those inconsequential, small, unintentional things that we do, knowing that it is those that have pinned them to that tree, would it change us? It wouldn't be enough to say, oh, I'm sorry, God, and then continue as we are. It wouldn't be enough to just simply say, oh, well, I'm going to be forgiven anyway. The seriousness should really strike home. And when we read what these people were asked to do and asked to give up, we should really begin to feel the seriousness of sin. We should hate sin. We should really despise it and what it ultimately cost. Because however many animals were killed in the sacrificial system, that is nothing compared to the cost of our sin. And I'm afraid that all too often we do have an idea of cheap grace, of being forgiven easily, simply because it's easy on our part. It was not easy, and it's the most expensive thing ever bought, our salvation. And we should treat the sacrifice of Christ in that light. Our gratitude to God should be in that light, and the inspiration to be better, to be the people that reflect God, should be all the more in light of what it cost. I wish I had the time to go through dozens more examples, but tonight I have overrun by 2 minutes. So you have my apologies. You have some notes, KP 1 to 5. So things to remind yourselves when you're reading the law to try and get the most out of it. And I hope that this has helped open a door to reading the law better. Let's pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we do indeed come before you. We thank you that we have your word that reveals you and tells us how to be God different. I pray that we would be inspired by what you have done and what you have revealed about yourself. Thank you that you felt the price worth paying. And I pray, Heavenly Father, we'd be conscious of it as we try and live lives that reflect you, I pray. In Jesus' wonderful name, amen.